coffee in today. I have not seen the article today.
Oh.
Today. Which one?
It would be too much to expect that the paper I would have to bring is actually here. Do you want me to, I can go pull an article while we're waiting for people.
Are you talking about the shelter applications?
Yeah.
Yes. And I can talk about that.
I thought our agenda was good.
Yeah.
It covered a lot of this.
Yeah.
While this is just about applications, a lot of information about what the resources are right now and things like that, that a lot of people in the community don't know. So they've been really having quite a few articles on this.
We can go ahead and begin and just skip the action items.
Well, at least let's go around with your introductions, because we have a new board member, David Olin, today. And so he'd like to know who we all are, I'm sure. Let me know if I mumble, because I have a habit of doing that. So, take it away.
All right. I'm Ellen Green. I'm with Community Representative District 3. My day job, I manage the Family Resource Center program in every public schools.
Me? Okay. My name is David Poland with a P. I spell P on Facebook. I'm at large, but I'm for the representative for the deaf community. And I'm going to make a suggestion to change the minutes where it says hearing impaired to deaf community.
Okay.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Abdul Majid in the Monadic Community Services. I'm part of Michael's team. And just here attending today as a new person here to learn about your services program and what you do.
What was your name again?
Abdul Majid.
I'm Beth Landry. I work with Rebecca and Michael on the homeless programs mostly, so the homeless crisis response system.
Good morning, I'm Jackie St. Louis with the City of Vancouver, with the City Manager's Office in the capacity of the Homeless Resource Manager.
And I'm Peggy Sheehan. I also work for the City of Vancouver, and I manage funding for housing and homeless projects.
I'm Janet, and I'm with Clark County.
Tom Breinbach with SHARE.
And you're representing?
You're representing the prairie communities?
Low income.
Low income, yes.
Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Good morning, Alicia Topper. I'm Clark County Treasurer, District 3 Representative.
And good morning, I'm Michael Torres, Program Manager here at Clark County for Community Action and Housing Development. So for those that are new, we oversee the county funds that, you know, Community Services Block Grant that goes into Community Action, Affordable Housing, Homelessness, Veteran Services, Human Services that bring self-sufficiency and other things.
I'm Rebecca Royce, Clark County Community Services, staff to the board, and everything that that entails.
Hi, I'm Lydia Sanders. Sorry I'm late. I got caught behind that darn school bus in North County, and that takes forever. What are we doing? I'm the co-chair, and my co-chair of the vice chair of the CAP board.
Been on the board for, I don't know, like, so
almost
8 years?
Almost then. Yeah, this is your ninth title.
Then I'm aged out.
And I'm Bridget McLean, and I'm chair this year, and I want to welcome everybody. We don't normally have so many visitors, but it's we move ahead for this year's work. We've had a summer break and we're ready to get back to business. And we have two interpreters, so we need to speak clearly. Oh, so we can catch everything. We want to welcome David. New members are always welcomed and good. It might be enough time to do the chili resignation right here. We have had an email from Sherry Thun. She's been a member of the board for some years. And sadly, she changed jobs recently, and it really doesn't fit her schedule, and she'd be missing several meetings. So she has tendered her resignation. And she is a low-income representative from District 4? What? So that will be a vacancy that's Rebecca will follow up on. I just think it's appropriate to thank Sherry for what she's done. It's been heroic to get to meetings through public transportation, shifting schedules, and we value her contribution. I invited her to attend any time she wanted to, so she could at least carry on with input, but I know it's difficult, and thank you. July minutes, does everybody have a copy of? Yes. We have one suggested correction to amend the language on from
3 months.
What was it before?
My suggestion was on part three under board member update. Second line, which says David Horn is representing the hearing impaired community. I'd like to change that to the deaf and hard hearing community.
That change will be made. Are there any other errors or omissions? So a motion to adopt the minutes would be in order.
I'll move.
Of the draft report to the community. Thank you to all of those that gave us feedback. A few board members really went into the details and found a lot of minor typos or suggested language changes, and I really do appreciate that. It takes a team on a huge document to get it to its best appearance, so I do greatly appreciate it. We sent those changes to the communications department, and they sent us back this final version that is ready to be adopted with all of those changes in there. So we just need to adopt it today, and then we will post it on the website and send it out to all of our stakeholders. We'll make sure to copy you, so if you have anyone you'd like to forward it on to and just show the good work that we did in 2018. That's great.
Looks very nice. Mm-hmm. To compliment them on their layout. Does anybody have any questions, suggestions? We'll make massive changes and flip it back. Discussion.
I'll say something. I think it's interesting on page number 9 that employment and SSI, SSDI are really kind of neck and neck with sources of income among people in poverty in Clark County. That was really fascinating.
And that's from the survey of needs that we did back in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Say how much many people were not only low income but also had a disability, and that.
Yeah,
poorly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I think of a motion to accept and commence the October meeting.
Comprehensive report would be in order.
Can you repeat the last thing you just said? Accept the motion of what?
Accept the Community Action 2018 report.
And then to accept?
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Yes?
Okay.
Bridget likes to lose her agenda.
I lose more important things, so.
Rebecca, the 2019 outcomes report.
All right, so this is the last time you will see this monster report. We will be redesigning it for the new contract period. This is the final report for contracts starting to January 2018 through June 2019. Everybody should be pretty much spent out. You'll see some didn't spend out completely, which is, it happens, you know, not every dollar always gets spent out. The important area where it was spent out was our consolidated homeless grant. Those are the funds that if we didn't spend them, they would have gone back to the state. The Community Services Block Grant, PIC spent out all but just a few thousand dollars for the program. We have 18 months to spend those, so it just wraps into the new contracts that we just put in place. We knew the Rent Well program wouldn't completely spend out because of staffing changes that happened in there. Organization where they had some of things have full time and now it's a half time person. So we're okay with the programs that didn't completely spend out. We just recaptured those funds to reallocate them out to the new program starting July 1. I didn't see any major outcomes that stressed me out. Most of them were able to, you know, meet or exceed their outcomes. The Community Housing Resource Center did see a significant drop in the number of households that they serve, but we did work with them, and they started working with SHARE and the Council for the Homeless, so that they could serve a more specific population, but those households took longer time and more counseling, so they weren't able to serve as many, but who they were serving was a more specific targeted population. And the council and SHARE have both expressed a lot of gratitude for the Community Housing Resource Center for the work that they did do with these populations, and it really made a difference to go help people who are literally homeless get into housing. They did a lot of landlord debt reduction and credit repair so that people could, landlords would accept these households in, into their market. So I'm not worried. It was a much harder population that they served for the last year and a half. Unfortunately, they did not receive continued funding, and so they will not be able to continue providing services to this specific population. I've been talking with the Council for the Homeless, and they're hoping that they can find some other funds to maybe continue that partnership, but right now they're unable to do that, so they're going back to the populations that they have more traditionally served, which is people who are more of a median income and first-time home buyers, where they get other HUD funding for those programs.
Also, the SOAR program, 50% spent, exceeds at 72%, and that's primarily because the main staff person with CSNW was out on protected medical leave for several months during the contract period.
So, I have a quick question about the Housing Resource Center. Mm-hmm. So basically, from what you were just saying, they'll be able to serve people with a little bit higher income.
Correct. So their HUD funding will cover people and more targeted to that first-time home buyer population.
Yep. Oh, okay.
First-time home buyer, not renters?
Correct.
So that is that going to be the only people they can serve is first-time home buyer?
My understanding is at this time their executive director also retired, so they're under some staffing changes. They have an interim executive director who is one of their board members. And so their focus really is going to be on the first-time home buyer population.
So, Rebecca, we have a contract with them that they do eligibility for the rehab program as well, which is not first-time home buyers.
Correct. Yes, they do serve, but they're all
but do
different populations. They're not going to be our targeted people experiencing homelessness.
Madam Chair. Thank you. So when I was working with Vancouver Public Schools, right, at the time where the mass vacate notices went out to Courtyard Village, when we were looking at placing a lot of those hard-to-place families that had eviction history, really bad credit rating, the Columbia House Resource Center was like our saving grace in being able to work with creditors to get their credit fixed and to really help families get deals with landlords that would put them into housing. So I wasn't here when we did the funding round. Obviously, I'm new to this board. But this, I think, is an unsung hero in our community, and they are the only nonprofit that provides this service. So I do worry about those families that need to get into housing from homelessness that won't have that avenue or that resource to help place them and get rid of some of those blemishes on their record that otherwise wouldn't be addressed. So I just wanted that noted for the record.
So can I make another question or comment question about that? That carryover funding from these different sources, so that haven't been used, would it be possible for us to use that funding to fund a program like what Alicia's talking about? Or is that going to go automatically to fund those programs that were already? Okay.
The latter.
Okay. And we don't have any choices about that?
Well, you did.
Okay.
You know, when you received the proposals and you scored them and you ranked them.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, that's the funding mechanism, you know, for our funds. And then once you make those choices, the funds go into the contracts of the proposals that were selected.
Okay. They go in at the level approved of that.
They go in all available funding. Because remember, everything that the levels you approve them at are just projections.
Okay.
So if less revenue comes in than anticipated, less than, you know, the exact number, you know, goes into those contracts. If more comes in, which includes funds that got recaptured, rolled over, or whatever, more will go into the existing contracts. But first, before they just go, you know, remember that we did have a lot of contracts that were underfunded. So, you know, funds that come in above projection or get recaptured first go in to make the programs that were underfunded whole. Yeah.
Do you see a possibility for there to be any flex funding or extra funding? Because we've had it come up before and with other funding streams that we would be able to, and then the second question is, could the Community Housing Resource Center open up again to those that are really low income or are homeless folks?
Michael, before you answer that, I just want to put out there that there were several HUD grants that the agency may or may not have applied to. So it may be good to keep an eye on the website and see, like, if you are really passionate, just staying in touch with them, because there are some other funding opportunities that have just in the society. So I'm not sure which direction, with all the changes that Rebecca was talking about, they're going to choose to go in, but it's possible that they'll secure other funding as well. So just to keep that in mind.
Yeah. And no, you know, I mean, we don't keep a pool of funds for discretionary use. We do have a list of trainings that have been asked for the community, you know, service providers. Have asked for and that are required that we will try to fund if there are any funds available, but there isn't anything that we have that's just discretionary. And what we're talking about here is a proposal, you know, a program that did submit a proposal that was reviewed that you as a body decided not to fund. So we can't really kind of go after the fact and be like, well, let's,
right.
you know,
this version of the report, yes.
So that's just a technical restructuring.
Yes. So, yeah, we haven't started yet, but we will be starting to look at redesigning this report so that you can get that system level view of the programs, including in all of our contracts, we have system level goals for the homeless crisis response system, and really trying to make it a more friendly report where you know this is onerous and confusing. We're trying to meet organizational standards with program and fiscal updates at each meeting. And so, yeah, we're going to redesign the tool to hopefully make it more friendly, not only for this board, but the public in general, to look at it and get a better idea of what's going on. What exactly it will look like, we don't know because we haven't started yet. But we're hoping to make it more user-friendly.
Okay.
Less bureaucratic.
I suggest we have some drafts that we can provide input so that we don't end up with something that we still have questions about. So that would be really good. Because this one is the financial one, and then we get the other one, which is more program focus.
This is the program focus. And then we have the other one that's provided twice a year, that is the fiscal report from our finance person that breaks down every contract with every specific funding source.
Okay. Yeah, then that's my concern is always that we don't get enough detail around the outcomes on this report. It's confusing. So that's great. Thank you. Questions on the report? Anybody? Then we will accept and adopt the report to the community. Oh no, we have to have some 2019 outcomes report. Do we need a motion on that?
No, that's just information.
Plus, of course, the advocates and committee has met a couple of times, I think, since last time. We did have more members, and that has been a great job. Recording actions and minutes and making suggestions. So, do you have anything you want to add?
I think that we're still able to accept a member if anyone is interested.
I would like to remove myself from that board only because I'm really strategically focusing my efforts on Battleground in North County, and so I just feel like I'm spread a little thin. But I would really encourage any other board members, this is an opportunity where you can really make recommendations to the rest of the board about how to advocate and what the most effective things can be in our advocacy efforts. And we've come up with a lot of really fabulous ideas from being on that committee. So if anybody wants to step up, I think that would be super cool.
Please remember that the advocacy task force is not the one that's the only members doing the advocacy efforts. It's really about trying to get the word out about specific advocacy efforts and where we should be moving the board towards and what we should be focusing on. We ask that all board members help in advocacy to get the word out about issues that are coming up for our community that's living in poverty. For example, the federal government wanting to change the index on how they determine the poverty level. Those will drastically affect our communities. And so having your say is really important to get that information out and up.
And I think a lot of the times it's simply sending a letter with CAB in support or in opposition of something is a huge statement because you guys are the CAB for Clark County. That's a huge voice to have in those unified letters when the advocacy task force and the board.
mentioned too, and correct me if I'm wrong, Beth, but community members can also be part of that advocacy group, right? Because it's,
yes,
it's open.
It's yeah.
So it may be when you're talking to folks and people are like, oh, you know, you're on the CAP board, what does that mean? It may be a good opportunity for people that you know who want to advocate, who don't want to necessarily or can't be on the CAP board for some reason, they could be a part of that advocacy task force to let their voice be heard and to be part of the solution.
The other thing we talked about at the last advocacy meeting, was, and it's highlighted by the discussion we just had about the Housing Resource Center, for example. There are a lot of organizations we don't and can't fund, and a lot of them are doing really good work, and there's a lot of interest in the community about what solutions out there that support reducing homelessness in the community. So that one of the things we talked about was highlighting in some ways, however we do it, different initiatives in the community that are supporting the mission of CAF, essentially. The one that we talked about was the one that's upcoming, the Walk in Our Shoes event on October 6th. I mean, it's, and not advertising it, but just highlighting the amazing work that goes on that doesn't get the formal funding support because the criteria and the organizational security and stability sort of limit which nonprofits can get state and federal funding. So thinking along those lines, we are a forum to focus on all those initiatives, even though we don't take action on them and can't fund them.
I would be interested in asking to know when and where it would be to task force.
Typically, it meets the second Tuesday of the month.
First Tuesday should be the months where the CAB board does not meet, so even number months at the diner.
Sorry, which Tuesdays?
First Tuesday, even number months, 11 to noon at the diner off Mill Plain. I think it's 5303 Mill Plain. It's by River Maiden. But I can send out an email to the board afterwards to confirm the address.
That'd be great, thanks. What was the name of the restaurant again?
The Diner. It's the diner that, yeah, it's the diner that supports Mills and Bills, I think it is?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a good supported notion of a nonprofit in this community that is the community that we focus on.
So I'm not able to participate just because of time, but I will be spending a lot of time in Olympia next year because I'm working on some legislation that will help keep low-income people in their mobile homes that are subject to potential constraint. So I can help deliver letters or talk to legislators once we have our agenda. I'd be happy maybe to phone in on a couple of those meetings if that's a possibility. But I think it's really important. I'm sure this group coordinates with the other nonprofits that are putting together their legislative priorities and agendas, and that are marrying and leveraging those groups' voices as well. But I apologize that I'm not able to participate because that's something I can enjoy doing.
One of the things that we do try to encourage board members to do is to participate in the advocacy day in Olympia and share really good job on coordinating transportation and that sort. I confess I haven't made
it. Is this the housing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's something to keep in mind for all board members because sometimes it arrives at the last minute. If your planning calendars well ahead, that's typically in February. So
I haven't been on the bus yet, but I heard it's kind of a party bus.
I think it would be fun. But here, we have a bus.
Only a party bus in the sense that everyone's really really happy next time.
Yes.
No mimosas.
No mimosas.
Spanish coffee.
Yeah, I went 2 years ago this year because I saw it advertised. I didn't see it time advertised this year. And so I went and, you had to get really early morning, still dark out, and it's just huge. Plus, they take them. Some people are talking. Sorry. And we arrived there, we went to a church, we all sat down, we talked about things, we met with other people from different cities, different counties to discuss at tables and brainstorm stuff, and then we all went together and then we go to different buildings and legislature and stuff, and that was kind of interesting to do that. And I think it was pretty successful too, which was good. Then we had a break, we had some lunch, which was good, so I was going to do my name. It didn't rain, that was
good. I've went in the past too, and it was exciting, fun, and a very long line for the sandwiches that were given out.
But, oh, I went early.
I didn't go last year though. I have time constraints, otherwise I would love to be doing that too. So maybe in the future. So.
We randomly picked that time to meet. At the time we did, it was the day council didn't have a morning meeting, but now council's changed its time of meetings and there are new members on the committee, so anytime we want to change it again, we can. It just takes some notice because it is a public meeting. It is on the website, so we have to notify people prior to any change. So that's why we're still meeting on that second Tuesday. It's kind of an odd time, and if it doesn't fit with people's schedules, we can't change it again, or the committee can change it again.
Yeah, I was going to say, that would be an issue for a lot of people, unless they happen to be working right there, and they can take it off as their lunch break. Me, I take the bus system, and I'm still searching for a job, and so I cannot assume that I'm going to get a job right next door, and I can walk there after my lunch break.
Yeah.
Right. And then that is one of the reasons why that location made sense. Because Adam works around there and Cameron works around there. So
yeah,
it just made sense at the time. Okay, moving right along to community needs assessment.
So I am still trying to get the task force together for the community needs assessment. I sent out a doodle poll to try to determine the best reoccurring day for the task force. And I'm still waiting for a couple of responses, so I will send out a reminder to get that information to me so we can get those meetings set up. We have a draft of the SMEET survey to review, and we'll talk about, you know, kind of what the task force will be doing during the meetings for the next, you know, year or so while we're reviewing the entire community needs assessment process.
Can you give us the timeline on that? I mean, you just said year or so. When is it actually due?
We have to have it adopted at the next, at the November 2020 meeting. And that's the full needs assessment.
That sounds like a long time from
now. No,
it's not.
I know it's not.
I'm already feeling stressed about it.
In reading the book was put together, that's a lot of information to compile.
So we'll be doing the same sort of things like the survey, some sort of public outreach in the process. Those
We would like to do more community forums if we can. So we'll have the survey because that's always the most telling information that we get from this whole process. So that's a bulk of what we'll do. And then we will design some community forums. I would like to do 3 of them this year, but we'll see what happens. And we'll be looking for assessments done by other organizations so that we can look and see what their findings are about what's going on in whatever niche they have. And then, you know, kind of putting all of that information together.
Can I add something like that?
The only thing I really want to say about the community needs assessment is that this is a really, really important tool that drives how we make funding recommendations, honestly. And we all know that data is only as good as how it's collected. And so this is an opportunity for really, if you want to really get involved and really get into the weeds of how we're collecting that data, how we ask the questions, how we distribute those community needs assessments, all of those kinds of decisions are made at those community needs assessment task force meetings. So I would really, really strongly encourage anybody and everybody who can to be part of that. Even if you can't make every meeting, be a part of that, because how we collect that data is so critical to how we ultimately end up making funding recommendations.
So, if you want to be part of it, Rebecca, no. It was a good sales pitch.
Mine will be very short because.
Oh, because where I had a actually talked.
I can always figure out something to talk about, but so I don't have new updates from what I passed out in our last meeting. Remember the organizations we primarily work with to get legislative updates are the National Community Action Foundation, the Washington Low Income Housing Alliance, and the Association of County Human Services, which works under the Washington State Association of Counties. So we're between sessions right now, and all three organizations are actually putting together their legislative agenda. So I don't even have a draft legislative agenda to share with you yet. I will share that quite a bit of effort with both the Washington Low Income Housing Alliance and the Association of County Human Services right now revolves around last year's Bill 1406, which allows a portion of sales tax revenue to be locally retained for use by the local governments, it could be cities or counties, for affordable housing. There are a couple more options in terms of rental assistance and funding of services if the county is less than 400,000. But really, for Clark County, we have, you know, our population is such that really we can only use it for affordable housing. For Clark County, that revenue is estimated to be around $500,000 a year that it would generate. The county needs to take a couple actions in order to be able to retain that funding. The first one is they need to pass a resolution of intent that they're going to collect the funding. And the second one is they need to make an ordinance change that really, you know, allows the funding to be collected and how it's going to be collected. Clark County does intend to leverage 1406 and retain those funds, and they have passed the resolution of intent, and the next step is going to be the ordinance. The person coordinating that effort in the county is Lindsay Schaefer, the policy advisor. But she is working pretty closely with Vanessa, my director, and with Andy Silver as well in terms of just consulting with the Housing Authority. Internally, there is discussion of, you know, this is one of the reasons they haven't gotten to the point of actually doing the ordinance change yet, is the funding does not allow for any use as admin for administration of the fund. So the county, you know, if you've been reading anything regarding county budgets for the past 2 years, you know that they're very stressed general fund-wise. So we're not really sure how to administer it when we collect it. And, go ahead.
Wouldn't the state just collect it during their normal sales tax collections, and then the state would just remit those once a month to the treasurer who deposited into a fund?
I'm not sure.
I don't know if there would be a lot of additional administrative burden.
Well, Well, so the administrative burden, I think that there's concern over is not so much in the collection of it, but in terms of how do you expend the funds, do you run and request for applications, how do you select the proposals. That's my
implementation, not collection.
Correct. That's my understanding. But you know, even though I'm not spearheading it, but I'm not sure if the state would collect it and that makes sense to me. I wouldn't be surprised if that's. But in conversations about concern for lack of admin, it really is on the implementation side. What ends up happening can be different than either, but the two areas of discussion that I think is most seriously being considered for implementation is that community services, Clark County Community Services, would administer it. And it would probably be integrated with an existing body, probably the Urban County Policy Board, in a very similar manner that we do the Home Investment Partnership Program and the Community Development Block Grant Program. Or it might be pass-through funds directly to the Vancouver Housing Authority. So I don't know that those are the only two possibilities, but those are the two possibilities I have heard discussed so far. That's really all I have to update on.
So this is a sort of sideline question, or it's something that I haven't understood. But Aggies are on the left, Council for Homeless, and there's some structural organization that he's with that liaises with DHA and Council. Can you explain that to me? There's nothing.
Sure.
I have no questions. Doing good stuff.
Oh yeah. So he is an employee of the Vancouver Housing Authority right now as director of housing initiatives program. The position is funded through a collaboration between Clark County Community Services, SWATCH, and the Vancouver Housing Authority. I don't remember if there's any other organization that is contributing to the funding of that right now.
So when we have an application to the RFP process for, I think it was the services of the Navigation Center, it came from...
No, he didn't have it. I don't.
It was the new shelter that they were trying
to... Oh, okay. So Saeed. So I should interrupt you. Please go ahead and finish. I know.
No, I was just confused because it didn't come from VHA. It didn't come from Council of the Homeless.
Correct.
It came from a name.
Vancouver Affordable Housing.
Yeah.
So okay. The Vancouver Housing Authority has two nonprofits that it administers that does direct work with the Council for Homeless. One is Columbia Nonprofit Housing, and one is Vancouver Affordable Housing. Saeed manages Vancouver Affordable Housing, and I don't remember which. You probably know better than I do, Peggy, which specific housing falls under Vancouver Affordable Housing. But that was the entity that submitted a proposal for, I think it was $400,000 for shelter.
Right.
And yes, so that was not VHA, it was VAH. They are administered by the Vancouver Housing Authority. You know, there is a real relationship.
Okay.
So what happened with that? Because as we were reviewing, then we heard that it was canceled or it wasn't going to happen. What happened?
So as a refresh, there wasn't any viable timeline for when they were going to implement it. Mm-hmm. So the, and I'm going off memory here.
They didn't receive the funding for that.
There were a couple things. They didn't, they requested funding from city CDBG, county CDBG. You did, but the county did not. Mm-hmm. So the Urban County Policy Board, county CDBG did not fund it, and it was a good amount of dollars. And in their timeline, even with all available funding, I think it was September 2020 was their earliest. And remember, when we do our funding decisions, it's amount per year for a 3-year period. And we, you know, we were already And there was no no location identified, no no estimate of when they would have all the funds necessary to run the program operations. So there really wasn't a realistic timeline of when it would be implemented, and to if you had approved that, and you know we hold $400,000 a year.
Right.
For 2 years, maybe 3 years, when those funds are actively needed in other programs that are underfunded, there's just no good justification to do that with the public funds, like, you know. And I don't think their status has really changed since then, to be honest.
Can I ask another question about that kind of stuff?
Yeah. Sure.
Is there any word or any progress on the rehab of the navigation center?
We can talk about that.
Okay, cool. We're
so late on the agenda.
Yeah.
Or is it
but do we have time?
Well, just so you know, that was, unless you have any specific questions, that was my update. So we can move on to other agenda items.
So, Michael, you had mentioned three organizations that we kind of track for our legislation: Community Action Foundation, BILA, and the Washington Association of County.
So the Association of County Human Services, and they work under the Washington State Association of Counties.
Oh, they do?
Yes.
So just traditionally a pretty conservative agenda.
Traditionally it is. ACHS used to be its own nonprofit, and I think a year and a half ago they integrated with WASAC. ACHS tends to be a lot more progressive than WASAC. Initiatives or proposals or focus areas to the Urban County Policy Board. And the other thing that I don't think there's anything wrong with them as we're talking in the advocacy task force is, you know, making recommendations or sharing what your priorities are and what you're working on to Lindsay Schaefer, the policy advisor, you know, of the county, because, you know, they work with the Clark County lobbyists, you know, to set their agenda. So getting that alignment and coordination could be a good thing.
And just as a protocol for this committee, if we were this task advisory group, if we were to take that sort of position and we wanted to talk to Lindsay or we wanted to make a recommendation to CDBG, for example, on our position on something, that would come to a regular CAB advisory committee meeting and be adopted by the group or the task force or
I think it could be either.
Yeah, I mean the advocacy task force is so as long as cause there's kind of like a, as long as the focus is maintained and the purpose is to support the athletes and the living quality of the community, then as long as you're active in that I think it's fine. If you guys get if the advocacy task force has an item that they want to send a letter or have a meeting about and they want to confirm with the larger board that everyone's in support, there's nothing wrong with but you could also do that through email and say, hey, we've discussed this at the advocacy task force. So there's nothing wrong with reading that item.
No, please.
And the bylaws allow, especially as you being the chair and you're on the task force, making those kinds of decisions.
National Community Action Foundation, the Washington Low Income Housing Alliance, and the Association of County Human Services. The Association of County Human Services does not, I don't remember, they don't have a website where they do action alerts, so, but the other two do.
Which are part of the list of advocacy organizations in your orientation binders, and you can send that out again.
So, my understanding, the City of Vancouver has its increased its stake in the city overall, and homelessness response here locally, and has realized the need to invest more. One, I really take a look at the city response, about coordinating the response, and for that reason, they funded this position that reports to the city manager's office to Leonard Crawford, who is the deputy city manager. Linda Crawford. Linda Crawford. So that is my direct report to the city manager's office, and she reports to the city manager who is not having homes. This capacity, primarily currently at this point in time, just taking a look at the city response, how it's coordinating with what's happening here locally, and how it's held up specials with international best practices too as well. The city does have some initiatives that they are interested in. Pursuing one of those being the development of its homeless response team, which is will be a combination of social service and law enforcement, which is consistent with the emerging best practice that is happening across the nation. In this capacity, and working closely with our internal partners, including law enforcement. Staff to one, get a sense of how things are currently working and thinking about how to move that effort forward. Meeting with the chief of police this week, he's been very clear that he does not view homelessness as being a serious response. The police officers really want to be involved, but also understand that due to the frequency of interaction they have with folks who are homeless and homeless response, that they are in some ways neglecting some of their other duties. So looking at what that means for law enforcement and how we coordinated amongst ourselves and then, of course, external partners. So we spent a lot of time in the community with folks who are involved in this work in one capacity or another. On Friday, I went out with Saeed. He took me around to some of the Vancouver Housing Authority-funded sites. So in general, just really information gathering, planning. Subsequently, I will produce a plan which will then be submitted to our city leadership. There's also, in addition, an assessment that's being done, independent assessment that's being done over the course of this week, when I'm saying 4 days of this week, so that itself will be informed in the city's response as well. So, city looking to really continue its involvement, but to be really strategic about what happens going forward, and that is, once again, being informed by many of the folks who are represented in the room, but also some additional people. I don't really like talking about myself, but I come from, most recently I worked in Seattle in a very similar capacity. My background is in behavioral health. I'm a licensed mental health counselor. I still maintain my license. I speak Spanish, have worked on the East Coast when I lived there. I work predominantly with Latino American populations, also low-income communities as well, so that's my passion. By heritage, I'm Palestinian, so I'm an immigrant to this country as of the early 2000s. So I've lived on the East Coast and then most recently in Eugene, Washington, where I still currently reside. Father of two young sons and a husband. Outside of that, just really interested in learning more about the community and thinking about ways to do this work in a way that's really accountable to folks.
Really sounds like a strong investment of the city of Vancouver, the housing response. movement, strong movement initiative. Does this become a part of the strong movement? Who can move whatever strategic plan? Is that part of
the it's all linked, yes. Stronger Vancouver, for all of you folks, I don't know, familiar with it, but the City of Vancouver has been very successful in raising dollars for specific projects, affordable housing, for example, some parks projects, some law enforcement, and the business community came together and asked the city if they would look at all of the needs, not just cherry pick some, or and keep moving forward. So put everything on hold, had a group of folks that came to the city, and it was over 2 years, because we were involved in that as well. Have a group of folks that worked on what Stronger Vancouver would look like, and it's a way to move Vancouver into the next 20 years. So it's a different level of funding sources, but homelessness response is also included in that. And hiring Jackie's position was the City of Vancouver has never had a homeless response. It's just kind of fit into like my position in Chad's police. Everybody kind of does it because it's for the City of Vancouver, every single department has a role in trying to end homelessness. So we're really, and Jackie has agreed to try and help us lead that. So we're really excited to have him here, and we can talk about the other stuff as well.
First, welcome to Clark County. And I don't live in Vancouver, but we're all in Clark County, so welcome. But what is the timeline on your plan?
So it really will be dictated by a couple of things that are happening. So apparently there is the Alpha Project, Project Alpha, that will be here this week, that will be themselves doing an assessment. And for me, I don't necessarily think the timeline will be dictated by, one, the ability to be with folks. I'm thinking potentially at the least 3 months.
Okay.
I'm still sort of in information gathering phase. I've had some preliminary meetings, but I want to take my time, be very deliberate about what this looks like, and it will also be informed by the work that Alpha Project is doing too as well. So I'm thinking potentially maybe 3 months towards the end of the year.
What you've gathered so far, how has technology or the efficiency of technology in the homeless system played a part in any of what you've learned?
Well, excellent question. So one of the things we're finding that in terms of data gathering hasn't really been efficient or coordinated.
Right.
So take, for example, one of the things that we're looking at is with the city's homelessness response, complaints are bad terminology, so forgive me for using that, but requests for homelessness-related responses come through different channels, and they're not consolidated in one sort of repository.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of looking at communities' requests for homelessness response, we can't necessarily tell what the intensity of that is. Secondarily, in terms of collecting the data related to responding to those concerns or sort of encampment engagement type activities, the police collects the data over here and then other folks collect, and so it's not, we don't have a consolidated database where, so that's one of the things that we're looking at. I'll be spending some time with the folks from the comms department looking at, there's an app, I think it's My Vancouver app, where you are able to make those requests, but everyone does not use those, but taking a look at that platform and thinking through, is there sort of one platform that can be used across all of our departments where we can have sort of like one database. So I think we need to increase and improve our efforts there.
So I've seen a lot of service providers have to gather a lot of data for federal grants, state grants, all this. I work for the school district, that's what we do, is scholars and cross fees and collect information. And I've just seen that, some programs are literally spending half of their time serving the human being that walks through the door, and the other half of their time collecting the data, because we're using old school, still using paper forms, all that sort of thing. I know this is boring, I know people don't want to talk about it, but honestly, I feel like it's a very, very, very important part of the solution. So if there's any way that I can help with your efforts of gathering that or prioritizing the efficiency of data as it's related to everything in the homeless system, by all means, let me know.
So I don't have that card, but absolutely. And if you have your card, I'll take it. If not, I'll just give you the information.
Awesome.
potentially, but with HMIS, I don't know. I mean, in terms of what I've seen in other municipalities, there is reluctance, maybe a bad word to as well, but reluctance to open up that database to allow for law enforcement to interact with that. So we have to think about, you know, confidentiality and ethics of that. I know in Seattle what we did for the city's response was we created an app, a Dynamics app, that was utilized. So there is some ability in HMIs, but we'd have to have a conversation. That may be a case button, Council for the Homeless, us and, you know, maybe even law enforcement to see what's possible. It would be best, I think, best practices to integrate what's already happening, but if it's not possible, then we'd have to think about something else.
I mean, I do identify and recognize the differentiation between the needs of the city and why the position was created and the kind of the convergence between operations, the police department, social service providers, and having mass encampments, and then how do you do those cleanups, and then how do you get those people connected to services without them just wandering and bugging the businesses. So I think, I mean, what you're doing is really important work, but I hope the city recognizes they can't lose sight of the idea that this is a coordinated effort, and connecting and collecting that data for everybody to be able to better assist those in need, I think is, to me, like a really important goal. So I'm really excited about the work you're doing both in Vancouver, or Vancouver and Clark County. But yeah, I have a little bit of just like when the city starts thinking about doing it in isolation.
Well, no, it's not, and I hope that wasn't inferred by the conversation. I mean, in for everything we've done, we've looked at one, the action plan that was developed by homeless, by Council for the Homeless. Have had discussions with Kate, but and we'll have ongoing monthly at least meetings with Kate to make sure the work we're doing is integrated. It's not the city, and I think this is one of the reasons why the city was interested in having someone who can pay full attention to this, because they want whatever response it is to be coordinated.
I think that you said it when you said there are limitations with HMIS, and that's probably the biggest barrier mm-hmm. you're going to have.
I want to know how long you're going to be commuting and how much caffeine you're consuming.
So we have been looking at home. My wife more so than me. To be honest with you, it's I don't know. To be honest, my son starts school tomorrow. He seems okay. When I have conversations with him, he seems okay with the transition. He's not, the little one is 4, so I think it'll be less difficult of a transition for him in general. But I have my brother lives with me. He moved from Nashville, Tennessee, and he's still transitioning, him and his girlfriend. So they want to move to Seattle, but I don't think they're ready yet. So I kind of want to hold on until he's ready to move. And then I made that promise to him that he'd be with me. And then so once he does it, I'll feel more comfortable about moving. But we are looking.
You're driving from Seattle?
I drive from Puyallup.
Puyallup.
I was about to say, yeah.
Do you come down for a week and then go home on a weekend?
No, I don't. So some, like for example, some weeks I might stay a couple days, but mostly I drive back and forth.
So when you're ready, anything I can do to like help you relocate, navigate that and stuff like that.
I have some houses for sale, not me personally.
Oh, okay.
My neighborhood. Has
opportunity.
North Hazeldale, South Salmon Creek. It's the Blueberry Hill neighborhood.
Good elementary schools in
Blueberry Hill.
Yeah, it's a. Sarah J. Anderson, I have a first grader.
Okay.
And it's a little bit older neighborhood, but it's beautiful and quiet.
Okay.
She has like the safer cul-de-sac for playing. Kids.
Oh,
yes.
Okay, so that's what we're looking for.
Of course, that.
So it's a circle, and nobody comes in or out unless they need to be there. But
we're in one right now, so that's it works perfectly.
Yeah.
Of course, on the east side where I live, though, there's more shopping. So.
But it's a great community. I think you'll, when you relocate, I think you're going to enjoy it with your family. I appreciate it.
And I want to welcome you. Thank you for coming and introducing yourself today to the board. And we welcome you to come to every meeting. So we'll make sure you get reminders.
And these happen?
Every other month.
Every other month. Okay.
On the first Tuesday.
I may be prematurely, so but once again, thanks to everyone for allowing me to be here.
The city council asked that the services that are provided in our community regarding people that are homeless be assessed. So they're coming, they're just focusing their attention on the navigation center and the services being provided there. But as you all know, the Navigation Center serves the entire community, not just folks that are homeless in the city of Vancouver. So we're looking at all that stuff.
So they'll talk to the counties?
Mm-hmm. Counties and some county staff are invited to the conversation. Council for the Homeless, housing providers, behavioral health providers, Jackie, who else?
I think that was council members, city leadership. City. Are they talking to county council too, if I'm not mistaken?
I didn't see any county council on the list.
Excuse me?
Are they
talking to some people experiencing
as they will, so they will be at the NAV Center, and they're doing, is it tomorrow night, mm-hmm. they're doing a drive.
Okay.
I'm not really sure. The scope of their work, entirely. I really don't know. I can't say because the contract had already been, I guess, agreed upon before I got here. So I came to know of it in a similar way that you guys know. Maybe have some more details as far as when they'll arrive and how long they'll stay. But I know that they in San Diego they have a program that they run that's sort of homelessness focused. So, but I couldn't tell you what the
right, other and all the city council members have gone to that
most
to look at it. Yeah, maybe not. Did you go?
It was a donor funded mm-hmm. trip, so you know, some council members decided to go, some didn't. But yeah, I mean, I have very strong opinions about that, so I'll keep it to myself since it's an official board meeting.
Oh, some of us
go. Right, we'll have coffee later. I'll tell the record.
So, can I ask
that one you're leading to?
On the rehab of the NAV Center,
yes.
Where are we on?
So we have the City of Vancouver funded through the CWG program that we're going to do some changes on the Navigation Center, which include a ID program. So people coming in there will have to check in, and they'll have IDs associated when they move in, when they meet there. Changing the entryway so it's more controlled entry. Go ahead. Right now people just come in and go, and then the neighbors report that they go outside the Navigation Center and do drugs and then just come right back in, and there's no control. So we're looking at trying to have a little bit more control over the comings and goings of folks. We're going to be putting... Go ahead.
Is that going to be trauma-informed? Because this isn't sounding trauma-informed, to be honest. Like, this sounds like...
We're working with Cher on that, and it's something that they think that'll work as well. You know, we have to balance. It's a little different because we're right in the city, so we have to kind of balance the needs of folks that are looking for services with the needs of the rest of the community. So this looks like a way we can do it. We're going to be putting in an additional water heater and some HVAC units. So as far as the build out of the rest of the building, we have asked the Alpha Project to weigh in on that as well. Does that answer?
Yeah. I just hope that they keep an eye for how they can do it. I understand that we have to, make everybody laugh, not make everybody happy. You can't do that, but we have to take the consideration of everybody involved into mm-hmm. account. Totally with you. But I just think that unless we can ensure that we're providing every human being with the dignity and respect that they deserve when they walk in the door, we're setting ourselves up for
right.
even more problems and issues.
The feedback that we're getting from the people that go there is there's a lot of folks who are too afraid to go there because of drug use. Mm-hmm. So this is one way to look at limiting the drug use on site and right outside the door. And whether it works or not, that means we're sitting there.
To make it safe for everyone
mm-hmm.
who wants to go.
Yeah, because we don't, families feel real threatened when they go there, single women. There's a lot of folks that are really concerned. And there's they're seeing a ton of people. We see about 100 people a day. Interestingly, the stats show that most of the folks that go there only go there for two or three times, and then they never show up again. So we have a core group that comes in all the time. A lot of the folks that, the women that live in St. Luke's go there every day, and that's where they hang out. There's a lot of people that just hang out there because they don't live close today. Some folks in the parking lot, stay in the parking lot, camp in the parking lot all day, and then they get night. But the biggest issue that we have is where people go in there.
So as far as rehabbing back to that huge space, that's not only...
Oh, yeah, it is. We're looking at the navigation. We're looking at the Alpha Project to help us come up with that.
Okay.
And then we would have some community members, funders, because we have the county's one of our partners. We have some major partners with donor bases, so we would ask them to help us look at that. We are, there is a lot of conversation about having some shelter beds there,
mm-hmm.
Whether they're long-term or short-term. We're still kind of working on that.
Have you gotten complaints about a lot of people sleeping around in the neighborhood right there? And that's,
Well, people, when we have the next meeting of the Navigation Center, we have a community meeting, and the next one is September 10th. So if you'd like to stop by, you can visit with other folks that come there. We have a police presence there. We can ask them what they're seeing. But as far as the neighbors and what we see when we drive around at night, and I try and drive around there at least once a week at night, and there are people there. They don't have any place else to go.
Yeah.
When they go out, you can't stay in parks, any park in the city or the county. So you can only camp in right-of-ways in the city. I don't even know what camping laws there are in the county. Do you know?
Yeah, I could see where a neighborhood would be scared that after visiting the share house a few times and seeing how it was there, that the community might end up like that. So that could be a real fear for somebody. I mean,
Yeah, there's a lot of fear.
Yeah.
And that's really the opposite of what we want. I think that was the opposite of the intention.
But I think one of the things that was most poignant to me is when the permit hearing took place, the opinion was that a lot of the fear wasn't based in fact, it's just fear.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's hard to alter that perspective when it's not based in fact.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you've seen something somewhere, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen. I mean, I've got people sleeping a block from my house,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, it's just part of reality right now all over the country. So it's a very difficult position for the city
mm-hmm.
and to balance the needs of our citizens and balance the needs of our neighborhood. So wishing you much
better. Well, it's great. It's still a wonderful project. Lots
yeah.
of people are getting help. Attracting numbers of people that get housing and jobs and all that other kind of stuff. So
but the hearing,
we can only make it better.
Is good.
Yeah. So, and then I also...
My reaction when you listed what I was doing is it was more that what I'm hearing the problems are, the people hanging around outside and interacting in the neighborhood without the troubles neighbors. So what you described with ID and entry are internal to the Navigation
mm-hmm.
Center as opposed to that interface with the community.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why... And I agree with the biggest rules in there and a little some structure, but like Linda said, it's a question of how you shake those
mm-hmm.
so that it may well be that the regulars there have identified ways in which they think they could be safer. I'm not sure IDs, et cetera. So that was just a personal
mm-hmm.
reaction. So
well, it's
I
open
apologize.
Every day from 7 in the morning till 5 at night, so feel free to stop by.
I think it's important, really important to add that the more trauma-informed that we make that,
mm-hmm.
however creative we need to make that, the less drama and the less fear we're going to have.
Mm-hmm.
And which is counterintuitive to what we all want to do, which is let's put more rules and regs in place and let's put more, you know,
mm-hmm.
controls over it. Which actually creates more of a barrier between people that are in poverty and those that aren't. And so I think that if we can really admit that and look at it and come up with the creative ways to empower and honor and respect those human beings that we're serving, the less fear we're going to have.
Well, and I would like to add, I know we're over time, but that if I think if this board or members of this board have these concerns, it's important to let Councilmember Lebowski know, because she's really our conduit to the city council as a whole, and they're the decision makers. I know Peggy and Jackie, you know, I'm sure they will bring this back, but it doesn't have as much impact unless it's coming from the voices at this table. Mm-hmm. So I would say, if you truly feel that way, just let her know.
And I'm also guessing that the Alpha Projects review is probably going to be discussed at city council meeting.
Sure.
Sure.
And we have regarding the whole ID thing that when we went to Denver, we looked at shelters and day centers there, and the ones that we've seen have ID programs. Mm-hmm. So it's not uninformed, it's just a different way of looking at it.
Right now
what we're trying to, the idea to try this was also, we worked with Cher and the police.
As long as IDs doesn't impact minority groups who already have a level of fear in this community.
Well, they don't have to carry them with them. So it's when you come there, you just say what your name is, where lanyards.
You don't have to actually flash an ID, like a government issued ID.
That's awesome. Oh, there's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So well, I mean, it's less invasive than having a library card.
Yeah.
They check in for meals at the hot meals program, and it's kind of a part of the.
Totally. It'll operate like that.
Yeah.
Are we in the affordable housing fund?
Well, I was just
yeah.
Say
you want me to do that?
Yeah.
Real quick. Okay. So we have this is a this paper is one that we created. So this is just the affordable housing fund. So on one part of this is the affordable housing fund, and some of you that live in Vancouver had the opportunity to vote on it was called Proposition 1 at that time, passed by 58%, which was the highest that anything had passed in this community. So this list here where it says Affordable Housing Fund is all the money and the projects that we have allocated funding for. And then the back page is just some other projects that the City of Vancouver has awarded funding for as well. And then this sheet here, and Bridget was alluding to this when she was talking about the newspaper article. So the City of Vancouver used the Affordable Housing Fund. We have this very small portion of the Affordable Housing Fund that's set aside for shelters. And through the past year, the faith-based organizations, many churches have met with city staff and the mayor, and their comment has always been, we want to help, we have ideas, how can you, the city, help us fund some of the ideas in order to help people that are homeless. So we issued a RFQ, and what we were looking for was an increase in shelter beds. It's pretty specific, and these are the folks that applied. And Bridget, like what you were saying, that the Patty Hastings did a really good write-up in the paper today.
Yeah.
So we got lots of information from her as well. And these are just these people have just applied. We haven't awarded funding yet. So that's all I have. So, if you have any questions?
That's impressive.
Mm-hmm. When you see it all on one page, it's very impressive.
Sure.
So all of these are existing programs except for the final one, right? Is Exchange Unit?
What do you mean existing?
I mean motel, vouchers, the
all of these programs are, they're operating in the community so far. The city hasn't funded any, very many of them that they've all operated.
So it looks like the West Shelter will be expanded to 24 hours. So
that's what they're asking for. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of these have existed in the community. Not all of them have received public funds.
So, and I just saw the definition, so I know this page, multi-family tax exemption, just as an example, when you say 2,267 units, so of those, 543 received subsidized housing since the second year, so it's not that
long. No. No, it's much simpler than that. The cities have an option of awarding a tax exemption for multifamily projects if they're in a certain area and if they meet a public benefit. And the city of Vancouver has adopted the public benefit as income. I mean, there's other nuances, but that's about it. That's
so that gives the developer a tax offset.
Property tax offset. No, it's the property tax offset is for the entire project except for the land.
And the commercial.
Yeah, and the commercial. None of these have. Maybe one thing else.
That's really incredible. That's
yeah. The city's pretty, we're pretty committed to affordable housing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of these projects have county money as well, housing authority. Money from cash credits and there are a myriad of different projects. Great. Anything else?
So with the new homeless coordinator, how will it shift it?
Well, the homeless issue has always just been an add-on to all the other stuff, and so we're trying to, you know, it's still a huge issue for the city, so but some of it will be, I hope I can focus more on housing, some more creative housing ideas. The city's going to be putting together a housing commission this year, so that'll be interesting. Much like, you know, we have planning commission and Civil Service Commission and all these other ones that will have a housing commission as well.
Neat.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff. Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Jackie slipped up, but thank you.
Yes, I will. I'll let him know.
So I'll be quick I'll try to be quick. You guys might have some follow-on questions. But, Doug asked to, Doug Bach, one of the members of the CAB, asked to have a discussion on the costs per intervention, because he read this article that Rebecca sent your way on the point in time count for homelessness. And you've had separate discussions with Dale on the point in time count. Doug's question was, on the last page, it talks about, towards the end, but rapid rehousing programs are expensive. On average, they cost $620 per day as opposed to $195 per day for transitional housing. And Doug's reaction was, hey, Rebecca, can we talk about that? That seems ridiculously high. And the answer is, it is ridiculously high. That number is completely incorrect.
That's what I was wondering. That doesn't seem right to me.
So where that number, $620 per day for rapid rehousing, came from? It came from a website that the Washington State Department of Commerce Housing Assistance Unit puts out, called the Community Report Cards, County Report Cards, and you can look up every single county and the data they get from HMIS is Commerce collects all information. They look at the numbers served, the different exits, different exits, successful exits to housing, non-successful exits to housing, total expenditures, things like that. The issue is we are a different HMIS system and vendor than the county, than the state uses. And there have been some ongoing incompatibility challenges when it comes to importing that data. These are known challenges. So the Columbian did see that $628 number. That was based on information the state put on their website. It is mathematically impossible to be that number, and I'll go into that a little bit more in a moment, but since then, the state has actually removed that information. And like, if you go to Clark County, they've taken out all the cost per information data out because they just do not have a good way to know yet. Hopefully by the end of the year, they will. At the time, my response to Emily Burgess, who's a data manager at Commerce, is like, hi, Emily. It's impossible those cost numbers are correct. For example, and these are numbers that they had on their website, our total cost per exit to permanent housing and rapid rehousing is not $92,943, which is what they had for a single person to exit the program, that it would have cost almost $100,000. With a cost per average project stay of $73,807 and a daily cost per person of $628. Last state FYI, fiscal year, based on our annual report to Commerce, total county expenditures and doc reporting fees, CHD, HEN, ESG, and Home TVRA on rental assistance, and that is all rental assistance, not just rapid rehousing, were $2,494,710. At a cost per average project stay of $73,807, we would only have been able to serve 33 households with all the funds the county expended in all intervention. However, for the same period, we had more than 160 positive exits to permanent housing and rapid rehousing alone. So what we believe our expenditures to be per intervention are a lot more in the norm statewide, which are about $16,000, just over $16,000 per successful exit in rapid rehousing, about $77,000 per successful exit in transitional housing, and a little bit higher than that with emergency shelter. So, and it kind of, it makes, you know, that's based on successful exits to permanent housing. So emergency shelter is about 30% of everyone that goes into emergency shelter successfully leaves emergency shelter into permanent housing. Transitional housing is just right around 50%. And rapid rehousing right now with us is around 76% successful exits, which is historically for us, and we think is a little bit artificially low right now because of rapid rehousing. Historically, we've been in the 80s. It has dropped about 10 points in the past year, and we think because programs have not been as good in the past year of collecting the exit destination. So we have an abnormal number of unknown destinations. And we think that once we correct that, we're going to be back in the 80s. So, you know, FYI, that's the conversation. Yes, 628 would be per day in rapid rehousing would be absolutely ridiculous. It would be almost $100,000 per exit, per successful exit, almost $73,000, a little over $73,000 per exit, whether it's successful or not, per person. And we're around 16,000. So, any questions on that? Yes.
My question is, so 16,000. How much is that on average? They cost per day. If I was to cross off 628 per day, and the entire sentence, how would you rewrite that sentence?
So I didn't actually do this. I didn't bring the average number per day. I want to say it's closer to like 99, just under $100 a day.
Like,
but I could verify that.
Like $40 to $100, depending on family size,
yes.
Like which program you're looking at. Because there are a lot of programs that are like very single heavy. So I guess you're looking wide, somewhere around $50-$60 a day on average. But
I would also say, you don't. You want to look at the cost per successful exit in totality more than the cost per day, because how long a person is in a program is going to, is going to completely be dependent on what that specific household's needs are. So you're going to have a lot of variation. you know, you're going to have some households that it's possible they might be in a rapid rehousing program only 3 months, you know, and others that will be in, you know, 9 months, and others that will be in 24 months, you know. So what we do want to know when we're doing projections and planning and stuff like that is what's the median and what's the average for a successful exit in their totality, so we can plan around that. And what you see on this around the state is rapid rehousing programs are generally, and what is true in our community as well, are generally the most cost effective. They're the cheapest for successful exits in terms of the rates of exit to successful exit permanent housing and the average cost. That's generally followed by transitional, and that's followed by emergency shelter, you know. Yeah.
It's like PSH is cheaper than...
Well, I didn't include PSH because generally, I've only said three interventions here because with PSH, you're not talking about exits to permanent housing. You know, you're talking about, you know, remaining on the program. So that's why I'm talking about these three. I'm with you.
Would it be possible that maybe by our next meeting we could get what those true numbers are for us for each of the different types of housing programs? So that cost per day that you were bringing up.
Sure.
And the total average cost to help someone out of this particular type of housing program.
Probably. So I can give you, yes.
Okay.
That'd be cool. You know, just know that right now and for past, like, between now and the end of the year, Dale is working on how that information is collected, and it's always going to be changing. So what I tell you next month, month after next, will be different. Won't be significantly different. I mean, it'll give you a good idea, but it's not going to be exactly what you see at the end of a program year.
Sure, but it'd be awesome if we could get the current for like what's happening right now.
Sure.
And the other thing to keep in mind is that the numbers that go to the state are not just what we fund through the CAB, it's the entire system. What we fund, we have prioritized households that are harder to serve, which are going to have longer term time in program than some of the other rapid rehousing programs in our community that are funded by other funding sources. So those also kind of
play into it.
Yeah, those variables also.
And those numbers were completely off. I mean, like, regardless I mean, like, we know locally that our cost per successful exit in all our interventions have gone up slightly over the past 5 years because the populations that we're targeting are households that have higher barriers, and, you know, which means they need more intensive services. And at the same time, the rental market has significantly changed. You know, so both the cost of housing, the amount of time that a household needs to have some kind of subsidy before they can afford it on their own, and the stability supports they need have all increased. That has led to an increase in cost. But nothing like, you know, a $99,000 for a successful exit. You know, not even close.
It's unfortunate that the reporter got the numbers wrong and that the state had them on there and pulled off. I mean, things do happen, but when you're putting something important like this into a newspaper that people are going to use in the future, you know, even in different places to compare things to, it's unfortunate that it's important because it's going to be very hard now to, like for me, when I get the information I'm going to be telling people, I know there will be a lot of people, including on Facebook, who are going to be asking, I'll be saying, actually the number's here, he gave it to me, and it's going to be changing all the time, and I'll do my best to explain. The newspaper is where they're going to look at. It's going to be tough.
And unfortunately, for everyone that's not in like the balance of state COC, and like there were several other communities where it was like 200,000 per year, and so we were not alone in this inaccurate number. There's several communities basically that are outside.
I think we're the only ones they've actually taken the data off.
No, I think there's actually a couple. Doug brought this to my attention. I went and looked, and I noticed ours was not on there anymore. I think there's a couple.
I assume that it was
It is, in the sense that it's a data standard, but the system that collects the information and processes all information is by vendor. They're different systems. So there are most of the balance of state in the state are on one vendor, and a lot of the different counties that are there, they're not in the balance of state, they're their own COC, are on vendors that they have contracted on their own. Yeah.
In your case, you mentioned standardization when you're standardizing that.
Yes. So, but that's all I have in that. Anything else? I'm listening.
January meeting.
Yes. So our January meeting is coming soon, and I wanted to get some ideas from the board. You know, typically in the morning we do business, we get all the things that we need to do every year done. And in the afternoon, we try to do some trainings. In the last couple of years, we had some specific things we wanted to do, like the bias training a couple of years ago. Last year was all about the request for application training. So this year, we're kind of open, and I wanted to get some suggestions from the board of what you would like to see for the afternoon training session at the January meeting. Are there particular trainings you would like to see? Is there a specific discussion you would like us to put together? We're kind of open. I also did reserve the Bud Van Cleve room at the Luke Jensen Sports Complex, where we've had the meeting the last couple of years. I've gotten positive response from that, so I was able to reserve it again this year.
Because I'm new, I would love to see, and because I work with finances all day, I would love to see a breakdown of all of the funding sources for homeless services that we work with and what their restrictions are. That would be really fun to learn.
What do you mean by restrictions?
So if it's a CDBG, what are the target populations and what can you not spend it on? So we know the targets.
Thank you.
I'm new here too, but because specifically I'm in the deaf community, and I know that we have certain issues that a lot of the homeless and house hoppers do not have that are hearing. I would like to discuss specifically deaf issues regarding getting housing and getting services by agencies. Because I do know that a lot of times things part of our culture actually to help us that we do has prevented some people here from being able to access some of these resources because of federal or state policies. So I'd like to discuss this. But I would also be really interested in hearing other minority groups as well, because a lot of times deaf people are intersected by being black deaf or being a woman who's deaf, or being an immigrant that has no language or has Russian as their language or Spanish as their language, and how that intersects with them becoming homeless and getting out of homelessness.
David, what is a house hopper?
Okay, a house hopper is someone who, for example, I'll just give you an example, because we do a lot of examples in the deaf community. A lot of people here in Vancouver cannot afford the rent. So what we do is we have friends that contact us and say, do you have a place I can stay? On your sofa, on your floor, in your bedroom?
Okay.
Yeah, we call them house hoppers. And they may not be on sofa anywhere. So a lot of times I've been asked maybe 3 times in the past year by people if I could do that. And unfortunately, the definition for homelessness does not cover that. But in summary, unless you are a dangerous person or someone that we have shunned, we are going to try very, very hard to get you a place. And it just so happened, the 3 people that asked me, only one of them I knew, the other 2 were friends of friends, and they were desperately seeking for a woman a place to stay. So they don't want them in the street, because sign language, signs sometimes, some people with mental illness will see that, and they will hurt them. So I would like to discuss those specific issues that my people have. I would like to also open to hear what people like from other races and people with disabilities, like in wheelchairs, people are being affected in those groups, because I hear a lot about military vets, a lot of people with mental health issues, but there's a lot of groups that I think we need to discuss because they have very specific issues that need to get addressed. We might get them out of homelessness a lot faster because there's just maybe one or two areas that need addressed. We're looking changes in the system, and that may not be a problem anymore.
Can we add how immigration status affects their eligibility for services too, depending on the program they're applying for?
So we need to talk about a format that educates, a two-way education, if you like, on whether what the system barriers are perceived or are. Sometimes it's you're afraid to go ask something,
yep.
But in fact, if you did go ask,
there would be a service provider.
Right. So it needs
to and then how
be, it's sort of around diversity and equality, but it's not quite, because it's more specific than that. So let's think about it. You mentioned shunning. Did you have any information of that?
Shunning? Well, in the deaf community, because it's so small, we will support people from around the world, since we have the internet now, in any ways that we can, and we're very tight-knit. And I mean, some people will even support people they dislike politically or religiously because we have to have each other back. That doesn't mean we don't stab each other back or gossip, but I'm just being honest, we're very blunt. But you have to be a pretty bad person and hurt a lot of people in order for the word to get out, this person cannot stay. I'm not going to recommend, if this person comes to your door, don't let them in. Because if they are having a severe problem with homelessness, we want to make sure they don't die. We don't like hearing people to exploit them even more. Hearing people that exploit our people anyway, we don't want to exploit them more. But if somebody, let's say, has raped people, we will tell the word to every, that guy there, don't talk to him. He's a rapist. His wife divorced him. He lost because of his kids. Don't even talk to him. So you'll see him on a bus alone. You'll see him in the street alone. There's a reason for that. So there are some people like that. There's also some people that might be oral, that talks and is not sign deaf. And people might shun them and say, you're not one of us. And they'll agree, I'm not one of you. So you might have somebody that had hearing loss, like the military vet, they're a hearing person. You might have someone that went to oral school and was labeled as thinky hearing, and they won't have anything to do with them. So there is shunning of some groups of people like that. So those people, they either be on their own or they have a friend who's hearing that will help them. But there, I'll just give you one example. There is a man who signs, but he is homeless. He is not a house hopper. But he had told me he will not go to downtown to receive services, including food or whatever, because he knows he gets threatened by other hearing people when he goes down there. So he came to him, or came to more the east side of the county, away from downtown, where everything's happening. So, you know, like I said, that's one thing of like a cultural discussion of what do individuals need to bring down their barriers, because it's possible that they have not communicated this with hearing agencies because you're not one of us, and they're not going to always tell you this.
David, I just want to clarify just one little thing with you. First, I want to mention my sister's deaf, and so a lot of what you're talking about, I've seen firsthand with her, and I'm really complimented, and I'm grateful that you're here to be part of the conversation. But also, I wanted to just clarify for you, there is a different definition of homeless. There's the McKinney-Vento definition. Have you heard of that? It's in schools, and it does include that what you're calling house hopping or couch surfing as part of that definition. And there have been over the years some different funding streams that are specific for that or housing, but they're very, very, very limited. And so most of it, of course, is the HUD definition of being literally homeless.
And I thank you for telling me that, because you see there's some confusion evidently. For example, I recently held a panel for deaf people to get to talk to people that were competing for position number 6 that could receive counsel. And unfortunately, there's so much confusion. One person who spoke, and I have this on video if you guys want to watch if you're interested, she told her personal story what happened. And then when it was all over, she talked face to face with these people. And all these people running, they're not stupid. They all had different perceptions of what homelessness was. And when she said publicly, I'm house hopping. I cannot get services. I went to the Council for Homeless. They denied me service. And they said, that's not true. That's not true. The state changed the definition. That's probably what you're talking about. The state changed the definition. They can help you. She says, no, they refused me. Well, that wasn't last year. No, that was last month. That is an example of where we need to find ways where she can get into the system to be able to get housing, because she's not someone that's going to have serious problems. Once you get her in a place, that's it. She's not going to be one of those people that the next month kicked out or something like that. But I think it's just one of those things where there's barriers up there simply because the hearing culture doesn't know about the deaf culture's values of what our processes are, and so there comes these conflicts. I think that's an accidental, obviously, not a purposeful one that we plan. And I think that's why I'm really happy that you were welcoming me to be on this board, because I cherish my people, and I would like to be a bridge to try to gap that information barrier.
I'll just add to you really quickly, David, the other thing is that it's not just the folks that you're representing that are having those challenges. It's everybody
yeah.
from poverty. I mean, it's really is across the board.
I mean, that gives you some feedback. We've sort of run out of time for open forum.
This is kind of open forum.
Yeah, that was.
I have one quick announcement. Next meeting, I'll bring flyers, but the state legislature this last session increased the income qualifying levels for seniors for the property exemption program. Three counties in the state had significant increases, and Clark County is one of them. So the senior exemption program for property taxes this year was $40,000. Next year it will be $50,000. So the assessor's office is anticipating about 16,000 additional seniors that own their homes will qualify. So I'll bring flyers, and Peter Van Gortwick, the assessor, and myself are going around the community trying to increase awareness about that program. But it's a really good change. It's a good thing to help these seniors.
Yeah. I'm happy to hear that.
Anything else?
Do you want to make a comment? You sat that quietly all the way.
Just observe.
Take it in.
The thing I would say, for example, is between the training, the request to maybe not rules that help. But we have an agenda of policy and procedure information sharing. But for me, is as a listening, is we have to always get a common formative, appreciate that is in some way around that, or including liquids, which you need in this talk. And there are a lot of people homeless, but when it comes to certain groups of people, given interest in trying to go receive services, some of them are threats to go even there. So I think David was talking about it's legitimate to differentiate between certain groups who are sadly, aggressive, encouraged to go, and some communities, LGBT or African American or minorities or immigrants, that always being targeted, things like that they are not getting those services. We have to be aware how to market, how to communicate to those people in those communities, and encourage them to be involved in learning about that, of the services. Also, there is unintended consequences, or like they would say, accidental, is sometimes even the forms or criteria or the language we use exclude certain groups of people. So
absolutely.
As we're developing policies or procedures or encouraging those communications, we have to keep in our minds how we are doing that to be inclusive of those communities. It's the same when you're talking about East versus City. Over, when I was in Portland, there's a lot of people that don't like to cross the bridge to go downtown. So just that is all information to add to what was asking discuss here.
David, I think it'd be incredible if you were part of the community needs assessment, because that's where you could really have a voice in framing and wording those specific questions.
Sure. Anything I can do to help? That's why I'm here.
Okay.
I'm a volunteer.
The next meeting is November the 5th, Guy Fawkes Day. We can set up fireworks.
Guy Fawkes Day?
Guy Fawkes.
Fawkes.
You are showing cultural.
You are being so British right now.
Anyway, November the 5th is our next meeting. So respond to
everyone check out Hands Across the Bridge? It was yesterday.
It was
amazing. Yeah. So I'm sure it's in the news. I think Channel 8 were there. So if you Google it, it'll probably pop up. I'm a big part of that. That's why.